The following recording by the LA Sound Posse is called The History of Globalization. It was recorded on May 19th of 2005 in Venice, California, and contains part one of a lecture by Professor Amory Starr. Amory Starr is an activist, sociologist, and documentary filmmaker. Her first book was Naming the Enemy, Anti-Corporate Movements Confront Globalization, published by Zed Books in the year of 2000. It was the first systematic documentation of the emergence of the alter globalization movement, which she actually wrote before the events of Seattle. Her second book, Global Revolt, also from Zed Books, is a beginner's guidebook to the movement. Contact information is given at the end of both recordings.
I'm Amory Starr, and it's May of 2005, which is a hard time to be in for North Americans, but there's a lot of hope in other places right now because people are fighting back. So what I want to talk about today is that history of globalization. And I am one of a group of scholars who divides this history into four phases of globalization, four historical phases. I want to start, though, by just mentioning that globalization is not at all the same thing as humanitarian internationalism, the process by which people travel around, work together, develop sympathy for one another, build relationships, have intercultural experiences. We call that internationalism, even though it predates nations. But whatever we call it, globalization refers to something else, which is a very particular set of economic and political processes. Globalization is constantly described as natural, as evolutionary, as inevitable, as progress. And that's public relations. It is none of those things. We also hear about globalization sometimes as if it's a brand new phenomenon, and in fact, it's not entirely new, which is why it's really important to understand the history. The last sort of prefatory point I'd like to make is that globalization is sold to us these days on television through the images of family, of multiculturalism, of women's liberation, of communication, and all of those things, in fact, predated it and have been damaged by it and have struggled against it. So we must reject the attempt to sell us a new system by using things that don't belong to it. So the first historical phase or form of globalization was European colonialism. And this is the British, French, Portuguese, Spanish, Dutch conquests of Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean, the Middle East, and parts of Asia, which took place from the 1400s to the 1900s approximately. The purpose of colonialism, it had a purpose. It involved a huge expenditure of resources. People weren't just wandering around bumping into each other. It was a funded project with a purpose. Its purpose was to get control of land, labor, natural resources, and markets in these places. In order to understand colonialism, we have to remember that before Europeans went adventuring, the people in these other places were doing fine. They had agriculture, they had trade, they had education, they had cosmology, they had medicine, they had jewelry, they had art, they had what we now call natural resource management regimes, they had math, they had science, they were using the experimental method. What's important about colonialism is that it was a very sophisticated system for taking control of people who were doing fine. And this system involved a lot of what I call tactics. These tactics were a changing mix of military, economic, political, legal, social, cultural, ideological, and even religious tactics. And I'm going to give sort of a few examples of these mixes and how they worked. We're familiar with the fact that colonialism often involved slavery. But slavery is actually quite inefficient. There are much cheaper ways. Controlling people's minds is much cheaper. Getting people to cooperate in their own labor exploitation is much cheaper than having to actually create physical control over each body. So all kinds of ideological and other tactics were used to convince people to see the outsiders as superior and to submit themselves and essentially hand over their stuff, their land, their labor, their resources, and their markets. Another example of how these tactics worked and shifted is that in India, before the British came, there was a very advanced system of agriculture, and people were wearing cotton clothes. In fact, British agronomists, agricultural scientists, visited India and said there could be no more advanced, careful system of agriculture than that that was already being practiced in India before the British Empire took over. So this advanced system of agriculture included growing cotton, and people were actually already wearing clothes there. Under colonialism, a combination of military force and taxation and other tactics were used to drive peasants off of their subsistence farms. These people then became what are called landless laborers, whereas before they were able to feed themselves from their own farms, and their roles as producers and consumers were integrated. Once they became landless, these roles, producer and consumer, were severed. British companies could then invite the landless workers to come work on plantations, perhaps their own former farms, and these plantations grew cotton. So through a few little tactics that didn't look like slavery, they didn't look like genocide, they didn't even look violent, it was just like some taxation, which worked to, and currency shifts, which worked to cause people to have to enter into a different economy in a different way, and who then lost their ability to subsist on their own, lost their ability to be doing fine the way they had been doing mostly fine before. Through these little tactics, Britain gains access to very cheap land, very good soil, which in the case of agriculture is the natural resource in question, and cheap labor. The Indian peasantry loses its independence and is now dependent on getting a job from British companies in order to produce and in order to consume. The British companies then ship the cotton back to England, where the Industrial Revolution has done exactly the same thing to the British peasantry, transforming the nature of society and the nature of work. And there are now factories with cheap British landless laborers to weave the cotton into cloth. The cloth is then shipped back to India, where the British colonial rulers have outlawed the production of cloth, thereby forcing Indians who know perfectly well how to make their own cloth to buy it. And that piece is called getting control of the market. So we've now seen land, labor, natural resources, and markets, and how at each of those stages there is an opportunity to profit by controlling people's lives, and that those opportunities do not always appear to be violent. Getting control of the market was simply a matter of being able to control the law, and yet that was as essential a tactic of colonialism as military force, as intimidation, as the ideology of superiority. So I want to say something about these different tactics that colonialism used, and I listed them off very quickly, so I'm going to go a little bit slower this time. Military tactics included war, of course, included the use of military hardware and forces to intimidate people into surrendering, but it also included the use of terror, and Michael Taussig's book, Columbia, really is an amazing contribution to the understanding of how colonialism ruled. In the rubber plantations, the workers, the slaves, the slave worker rubber gatherers were armed. They had guns, and yet they did not resist their enslavement. So understanding the role, and he explains it in great detail how it worked, understanding the way that people could be so terrorized that even armed they would not resist is an important part of making more complicated our understanding of the role of force in colonial rule. Economic tactics included taxation included the introduction of foreign currencies, which just that move alone can completely disrupt an existing economy. It can include the introduction of foreign goods, which are then valued in a way that can cause people to become confused about traditional products and their value. Political tactics included forms of negotiation that were unfamiliar to people, included requirements about who was seen as a legitimate negotiator or leader by the colonial powers. So, for example, in some societies, women, elder women, for example, made the decisions. They were not seen as legitimate leaders and decision makers by the colonial powers, and therefore the structure that existed in that society about decision making and foreign relations, which did exist already before colonial arrival, were again like disrupted. And all of these disruptions again undermined the coherence of these societies and enabled them to, in disorganized ways, to surrender control again over their land, labor, resources, and markets. Political structures could also include little things like, oh, all traditional land claims will be acknowledged, but you do have to come and prove that you own your land by presenting paperwork that indicates that, and you need to dress properly for our court, and you need to speak our language. So again, doesn't look brutal or, you know, that the rule of law itself can be an imposition which makes it impossible for people to defend what they have because they don't speak the language, they don't have European shoes, and land wasn't traced through paper. I also mentioned social tactics. And in fact, disrupting gender relations and creating racial hierarchies was a very powerful method of gaining control that colonial powers used. Among the indigenous people of the Southwest, one of the many useful things that the missionaries did was to reverse the gender roles. So what the women had been doing, the men were required to do. And so this created this cultural dissonance and insecurity and made people not strong in knowing who they were and in knowing how to relate to each other. So in that kind of circumstance, obviously resistance becomes more difficult. Many of the racial hierarchies which exist today didn't exist or didn't have the meaning that they did or were recognized but weren't hierarchicalized. Reorderings of difference were quite intentionally created as part of standard colonial rule. Culturally, the most important thing that colonialism did was to impose certain visions of what was civilized, what was desirable, what kind of product counted as art. And this degradation of thousands of years of cultural development, which grounded scientific decisions, grounded political decisions in traditional societies, was destroyed by this assault on the cultural value. And that's closely related with the sort of ideological assault of the notion of progress, the notion of science being something that didn't exist in traditional societies and only existed in the colonizer societies. And the sort of bumper sticker version of all of this is a sort of West is best idea, also devastatingly introduced by, in a sad moment of Christian history, the missionaries participated actively not only in an ideological invasion of people's cosmologies, insisting that Christian ways of understanding the world and what were superior and desirable, but also, unfortunately, the missionaries also participated in all kinds of genocidal activity, beatings, disciplines, and the imposition of all of these other tactics, the economic and the political and the legal. And in fact, it was much cheaper to send the missionaries than to send the army. Missionaries were sent first. If they were unsuccessful, then the military forces were sent. So these tactics weren't all used everywhere. Various mixes of them were used, whatever was most expedient in order to disrupt the society that had been targeted for colonization and to effectively take control over it. So if people would sort of surrender to and participate, start to obey the missionaries, then you didn't even like really need to enforce slavery. And as I'm sure is clear now, lots of these tactics get control of people's minds, get control of their activities without the use of very much force. Now, there was constant armed and unarmed resistance to colonialism, and eventually, more or less by around 1950, almost all of the colonized nations had mounted anti-colonial revolutions and had become nominally self-governing nations, meaning they had their own constitutions and parliaments and were supposedly free to have a process of deciding what sorts of laws they wanted to have. Now, it's interesting to look at those constitutions and the kinds of laws that were created. And what we see is an interesting process in which people showed that they weren't exactly grateful for what the Europeans had brought to them. A little humorous indication of how ungrateful people were was that the attempt to have a sesquicentennial celebration of Columbus Day in 1992 was a total flop. There were more protests and celebrations around the world, and in fact, the colonized people renamed that day Indigenous Peoples Day. Now, a moment ago I used the phrase nominally self-governing because in many ways the formal political decolonization was quite superficial. Indeed, some analysts claim that the process of decolonization is far from complete. It's an ongoing process. And in many cases, much of what colonialism looked like wasn't changed. In many cases, the colonial patterns of land distribution were not repaired, so that a lot of the best, most fertile land in post-colonial nations remains in the hands either of foreigners or of national elites who are using it to produce luxury crops for export, and it's not being used for local consumption. And there are many examples of this problem. But an important area that I like to emphasize about what remains from colonialism that's really powerful are the ideological effects. Many post-colonial peoples, what became called Third World peoples, or is now increasingly called the Global South, still accept European values and priorities. But everywhere in the post-colonial world, there are also movements working to figure out what it would really mean to decolonize, which values should be retained, which traditional values should be recovered, what to do about issues of language and so forth. And there's a very vigorous debate in most post-colonial places about exactly what to do about that, whether to emulate the values and culture of the colonizers or try to recover indigenous values or how to come up with a combination of them. Another reason that this process of decolonization was really difficult is that the nations that were inherited or returned and that became what I've been referring to as the post-colonial nations had no relationship whatsoever to the political, cultural, and social entities that had existed before colonialism. So what was returned were nations whose boundaries had been drawn by Europeans as a result of where various European countries left off battling with one another for control of the land. These boundaries, these shapes of nations and the contents of the nations were completely arbitrary from the point of view of the people who were then trying to govern them. And it had the result of all kinds of ecological problems, social problems, various ethnic groups being divided between two nations or more than two nations, so that the same group would be a minority in one nation and a majority next door. And it was very difficult for groups that were migratory groups to figure out how to have relationships with nations. These nations also involved an incredible array of different languages, which created the whole process of figuring out what language to run this new thing called a nation in. Even that process alone is difficult. So there was tremendous challenges for the post-colonial nations, and it's important, particularly in looking at Africa, to realize the amount of time and energy that's required in order to figure out what to do about all of those things. And so a lot of the difficulties that African nations have had, you know, we can really trace it to the continuing disruptions and arbitrary structures that remain from the colonial period. Another important piece of how colonialism functioned has to do with how it controlled the critical thinkers in the colonizer countries back in Europe. People in Europe were actually getting information about slavery, about massacres, about exploitation that was happening. That information was getting back. And so those people, some of them, thought that such things contradicted their Christian values and so forth. So they had to be controlled. They might oppose these policies. So how could they be controlled? And another tactic of colonialism was the ideology of paternalism, which convinced European citizens that even though this system seemed brutal and tragic, it was really better for the colonized people because they had been so uncivilized before. So enslaving and brutalizing people and destroying their way of life was recast as doing them a big favor. And one of the common claims that people have, or, you know, all of us, when we discuss globalization and we discuss the problems that we see now with globalization, such as sweatshops, which are clearly very degrading and dangerous situations for people to be in, people tend to say, well, it's better than nothing. And that is the continuation of the paternalistic ideology. We all need to do what some of my interviewees have done, which is come out of their chairs and say, it's not nothing. What we had before wasn't nothing. And what people had before has been destroyed, which leads to an impression of poverty and need, in which context a sweatshop sort of looks good. But we need to really, as with all social problems, look at what is the context in which there is poverty and need. And what I hope this introduction to colonialism has conveyed is that it's quite ridiculous for there to be a hungry or a poor Africa. Africa had every kind of wealth, which is why Europeans went there. And for Africa to be poor today is all on its own an indication that colonialism hasn't ended. And so next I'm going to get into the next historical phases of how it sort of didn't end. So the second phase, historical phase of globalization, is called development. As I mentioned earlier, by around the 1950s, most of the colonized countries were independent. They were having processes to figure out how they wanted to run their countries. And this was a very messy process for reasons that I've described in terms of the nation that they received not matching any pre-existing systems. And so there were and are ongoing really good processes to figure out how to manage this new form of the nation state, which wasn't traditional in any way. Meanwhile, while the post-colonial countries were trying to figure out how to manage a nation state and according to which values and how to deal with that, the former colonizers were in a panic because they had lost access to all of these resources that they had become accustomed to under colonialism, the land, the labor, the resources, and the markets of the colonized countries. And so while the post-colonial nations were trying to figure their stuff out, the capitalist European countries, and now we need to include the US in that, were in a competition with the socialist bloc for some way to figure out how to get control again over the post-colonial countries' resources. So the great historic struggle between capitalism and socialism looks quite different from a third world perspective. from the third world position, that struggle isn't really ideological. It isn't even really about class warfare. It's simply experienced for a long period of time as a struggle over which empire would have access to the resources of the nation. And I'm not going to get into the socialist bloc strategy for getting those resources. It involved favorable trade deals and so forth. I'm going to focus on the strategy that the capitalist countries used to get control of those resources, because that's the legacy that we've inherited and that we need to deal with. So the strategy used by the capitalist countries was the idea of development, which started in the mid-1950s. And development, for the purposes of this introduction, is approximately the same thing as modernization theory. The promise of development, and it was just a promise, was that if the third world countries followed the advice of the capitalist countries and pursued an economic strategy of industrialization, urbanization, no protectionism of the economy, just exporting willy-nilly and allowing for unregulated imports, that they would then get economic growth. And growth, in turn, was promised to bring an increased standard of living, meaning things like education, healthcare, longer lives, less infant mortality, infrastructure like roads and electricity and telephones, and even environmental quality. The promise was that the third world nations would slowly become first world nations, and even eventually, and this was sort of like the cherry on top, even eventually they would get to be democracies. Development theory also made a promise to the rest of the world. It made a promise to the people in the first world, which was that investing and supporting this project in the third world would give us all a benefit, and that that benefit would be peace. The idea was, as third world incomes increased and standard of living increased, peoples and nations would have no need for war, which is an interesting analysis of the cause of war. The premise there is that war is caused by poor people who usually don't really have the resources to make war, so it's kind of an interesting theory. But anyway, it's still really the promise. I mean, you can get on the websites of major development agencies, and really, you know, not much has changed from this theory. If you understand the promise of growth and the way that that promise is used to link in with peace, to link in with standard of living and nations being able to like afford these expenditures and quality of life, then you understand the basic logic that's used to sell this system. Not much has really changed. Now, I want to talk about growth a little bit more and why it's a very powerful term, and we need to understand it and be able to take it apart. Growth is defined with national figures, like gross national product or gross domestic product, GNP and GDP. And according to those figures, in fact, development has worked to increase growth. But a growing sector of economists now are rejecting those figures as measures of economic health of a country or well-being because of two big problems. First of all, those figures don't take distribution into account. A nation can have a very high growth, almost all of it going into the pockets of a few elites, and at the cost of the exploitation of peasants, of workers, of children who don't get medical care, at the cost of people, and that country would count as a success in growth. And the difficulty is that the economists make a presumption that when there is growth, that there will be this set of promised benefits to the whole country, and simply there is no determined connection between growth and expenditure of that benefit on any of these other promised areas. The second difficulty with national figures of growth as a measure of economic welfare is that these measures don't distinguish at all between socially beneficial kinds of economic activities and socially hazardous ones. So, for example, a large chemical spill or a disaster such as Bhopal, in fact, is good for growth. It generates a lot of economic activities for companies that are paid to clean it up and for healthcare for the victims. And so these kinds of major disasters appear as a positive contribution to GNP when really very few people would look at that as a positive economic event for society and certainly not for the environment. Now, to cut to the chase, it's been a 50-year experiment with the development approach in the third world, and there has not been a single case of success. The only case which you will sometimes hear cited as a success is South Korea. But in fact, South Korea is a false case because South Korea did not follow the prescriptions of modernization theory, but really had a model more accurately called state command capitalism, based on very tight protectionist policies which are not allowed within the development model. And a great book that looks at this is Walden Bellow and Stephanie Rosenfeld's Dragons in Distress. Despite this abject failure, development practice is virtually unchanged. And third world elites who are responsible for shaping economic policies in their countries, somewhat responsible, we'll get into the limitations on their responsibility for that a little bit later, they still pursue it and often believe in it as the only possible way. Modernization theory is enforced by the two most important financial institutions in the world, which are the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the World Bank. These two were created along with another institution that I'll be talking about later in 1944, ostensibly to regulate the economy after the war. The World Bank was to give large loans for infrastructure development, and the IMF was to give short-term loans in case of economic crisis. These days, their roles are far less distinct. A lot of people like to debate whether these institutions ever intended to do what they claim to do. I mean, they were actually not set up to do anything to the third world. They were set up to rebuild Europe after the war and to regulate the global economy in order to supposedly avoid like massive financial crises. Some analysts believe that the economic model that these institutions work with has proven itself to not work. And that these institutions sort of naively or without historical evidence having yet accumulated thought that these theories would work. Other analysts argue that the intention was never to really help nations develop. I don't think it matters so much what their early intentions were. I think that what matters is what they are doing and their insistence on continuing to do it, regardless of the devastating effects, which we're going to get into in a bit. So, a little bit of history of what actually happened. In the 1970s, OPEC was making huge oil profits, which got deposited to private banks all over the world. Banks, being banks, wanted to make money on the money, so they wanted to loan it out and get interest. But we were talking about so much money that nobody wanted it. They didn't even know where to loan it. And so the private banks came up with the idea of loaning the money to third world countries. Now, at the time, countries were not thought to be entities which could default. And modernization theory was popular at this time, and so perhaps the bankers believed, in fact, oh well, this money will help with economic development, and then of course countries being countries will be able to pay it back. They're going to grow, their economies will develop, and then they'll pay it back. So huge amounts were loaned out at very low interest, and virtually no oversight over what the money would be used for. The banks assumed that it would be used to develop the economy. And again, I'm sure there's a more suspicious interpretation of what the banks expected to happen. Again, I don't know how much it matters. But feel free to be suspicious about that. I encourage it. I just don't think we need to debate it for a lot of time. Much of the money, in fact, was given to non-democratically elected regimes and even to dictators. A lot of it ended up being spent on military to repress resistance movements in these countries. A good amount of it was spent on consumption, personal consumption of these elites, or put into foreign bank accounts. And some of it was spent on what are called symbols of development, like one skyscraper or an elegant airport or a fancy highway that went a short distance, perhaps from the new airport to the presidential palace. Very little of this money was spent on infrastructure or any kind of economic development that would build the country in the long term or benefit the poor. In the 1980s, interest rates skyrocket, and at the same time, export earnings in major commodities from the third world that the third world countries depend on for their foreign exchange earnings declined. And so this combination of interest going up and export earnings decreasing meant that the loans couldn't be paid. And at this point, the International Monetary Fund steps in to buy out the loans from the private banks. So what is really the role of the IMF? Is the IMF worried about the country in default or potential default, or is the IMF worried about what it turns out they're worried about, which is the health of major private banks? And what an IMF bailout is, was then, and continues to be, an IMF bailout is a bailout of international capital. It is a bailout of the banks. They don't even bail out national domestic banks in countries in crisis. They bail out the international investors. So the IMF at this point becomes the loan holder for the third world debt. And at this point they say, well, we'll roll over your loan. It's a bit like taking a second mortgage, but we want to make sure you can pay. So we're going to help make sure that you're running your economy in a good way. We're going to give you advice. So this advice takes the form of structural adjustment programs, also sometimes known as structural adjustment conditionalities. What structural adjustment programs basically do is liquidate the economy. This means that any natural resources, like forests, should be sold off. This means that money should not be spent on any kind of social services, which includes things like government inspections and enforcement. So massive layoffs, usually of civil sector workers. And, you know, it's really interesting because a lot of the times, like, nice people like us in the global north think that, oh, so sad that third world nations can't be like us and have things like battered women's shelters and at-risk youth prevention programs and things like that. These are the first kinds of things to be cut under structural adjustment programs. But again, what's really important to understand is that these countries had made choices to create exactly those sorts of things, and those are what they're being forced to cut by agencies like the IMF and the World Bank that claim to be about poverty alleviation and increasing the welfare of third world people. The liquidation includes the sale of any government-run enterprises, like transportation systems, like water systems, which are recommended to be sold off to the highest international bidder. These sales of government-owned services and enterprises is called privatization. In many post-colonial nations, the telephone, electric systems, other utilities were owned by the government, and the revenues from those, which was part of keeping costs down, but also meant that the revenues from these things went back to the government. Structural adjustment programs also include layoffs, wage cuts, implementation of user fees for basic services like health and education. And it's so important to understand that even what seems to us to be a tiny user fee, like 40 cents, can spell the difference between some healthcare and no healthcare. The imposition of tiny user fees mandated under structural adjustment programs in education have the result of very, very quickly all of the girl children being pulled out of school. Those are the kinds of choices that people make when faced with what seem to be very tiny user fees, but which aren't tiny to them. Structural adjustment programs include raising taxes, cutting or freezing wages, even repressing labor organizing, cutting food subsidies to the poor, and another one that's kind of a difficult one to understand is devaluing the currency. And this is one of those economic concepts that used to make my eyes glaze over, but it's one that we need to understand. Currency devaluations make a nation's exports cheaper on the global market, which is called making their exports more competitive. It also makes a nation's labor cheaper for foreign companies that want to come in and set up sweatshops. However, currency devaluations make any imported items more expensive for consumers. And since these economies are in a state of what is called distorted development, where they're often dependent on imports for basic goods that the poor consume, a currency devaluation has a very fast and devastating impact on the cost of living for just basic goods for the poor. One of the things that sometimes we forget coming from the global north is that you can't pay your international debt with local currencies. And part of why these structural adjustment programs do what they do, specifically the kinds of policies that they do, is that they're orienting this whole economy, instead of being oriented to produce what's needed for the people in the country, the whole economy is being oriented to earning foreign exchange, meaning first world currency, in which to pay not just any foreign exchange, but a first world currency with which to pay the loans. And so that is a further and massive distortion of how a whole economy is going to be operating. And many of the decisions made to increase foreign exchange earnings are not going to have a beneficial impact on local producers and the meeting of local needs. So again, when we think about like what is a healthy economy, most of us would probably think about that a healthy economy is one in which people aren't hungry, people have access to what they need, people are able to have some choices in their occupations, people have autonomy, people have control over what they want to consume, they can consume culturally, traditionally appropriate foods and goods. And that's not the definition of a healthy economy from the point of view of the World Bank and the IMF. From their point of view, a healthy economy is one which is earning a lot of foreign exchange. And what those policies that are going to produce that often work against people's needs. The leading edge of structural adjustment programs right now, although of course they're always renaming them, that's sort of a sign of victory for us though when they have to rename their programs, because it means we've criticized them effectively. The leading edge of structural adjustment programs these days is water privatization, which has an incredibly dangerous impact on the poor who can't afford to pay for water. It is a basic need. And many post-colonial countries had good laws ensuring access to basic services like water, and they're being forced by the World Bank and the IMF to instead allow their water systems to be owned by foreign corporations like the Bechtel Corporation from San Francisco, who are going to marketize the water. And what does marketize mean? It means sell it to the people who will pay the most. This will never be the poor. The people who are in the most need do not have demand in the market. Need is not demand in the market. Need is only demand in the market if you have need and money. So privatized resources, anything, water, electricity, food, is going to go to the people willing to pay the most. So, for example, most of the meat grown in Southern Africa goes to European dogs because European dog owners are able to pay more for meat than Africans are able to pay. So, you know, that's what a market-based solution does. And we need to understand that regardless of the amount of poverty alleviation rhetoric that these organizations use, these are the policies that they pursue. So it doesn't really matter what's on the plaque outside their building. We need to look at what are the policies and what are the impacts on the poor and increasingly on the middle class. So the results, just a few devastating statistics about these policies. World Bank economists document an inverse relationship between structural adjustment program implementation and growth. So the very thing, the linchpin of their promise, which is that their policies will lead to growth, which will bring everything else, even if we don't believe that, even their own theory is undermined by structural adjustment program implementation. The external debt burden of sub-Saharan Africa has increased by nearly 400% since 1980, which is when structural adjustment programs began to be implemented. And for the developing countries as a whole, from 1980 to 1992, the external debt burden has doubled. What does that mean? It means that Africa spends four times as much on debt repayment as on healthcare. Estimates on what is needed to fight HIV and AIDS in Africa range from $7.5 to $15 billion a year. Africa pays $13.5 billion in debt service every year. The bill to fight HIV/AIDS is unpaid because that money is going to debt service. We often are under the impression that these international agencies, the IMF and the World Bank, are helping, having a net outflow of resources to the third world. The reality is that for every dollar sent to the poorest countries in aid, 13 comes back to the lenders in debt service. World Bank figures from a few years ago, their own figures showed that $128 million is transferred daily from the most impoverished countries, from the countries at the bottom of the list, to wealthy countries. And these kinds of policies, these kinds of choices that countries have to make in terms of cutting their healthcare in order to pay these debts have a result of allowing infectious diseases that were formerly under control to return. Diseases like tuberculosis and malaria and cholera, which had been either completely under control or becoming under control, and these diseases are coming back. So these big, overwhelming statistics have a very direct impact on forms of suffering that maybe should have been abolished by now or ended through science. One other statistic that people like to use, and I'm just kind of going through a few of the ones that are most sort of powerful here. If the debt had been canceled in 1997 for 20 of the poorest countries, the money released for basic health care could have saved the lives of about 21 million children by the year 2000. And the math on that comes out to, and this is United Nations figures, the math on that comes out to about the equivalent of 19,000 children a day. Needless deaths. Deaths due to easily preventable diseases or even diseases that are the result of lack of clean water, basic things like that. And so that figure, 19,000 children a day, is important to keep in mind when we think about things like September 11th and the reaction of people in the third world to our suffering around that and kind of beginning to understand the level of constant deaths of innocent people, if we want to use those terms, that are caused by the economic system that New York represents to most people on the planet. Due to the HIV and AIDS crisis, life expectancy in Zambia is expected to drop from 43 to 33 years, a level last experienced in Europe in medieval times. And Zambia is actually a country which has received a form of debt relief under something called the HIPC, Highly Indebted Poor Countries Initiative, which is one of a number of forms of debt relief that the World Bank and the IMF have had to implement because of so much wonderful global exposure and resistance to their policies. They have actually pretended to implement debt relief. And one of the main problems with their debt relief programs is that they generally require several more years of structural adjustment program implementation before the debt relief actually occurs. Anyway, so Zambia, with facing this incredible crisis of death, even after receiving HIPC, is still spending more on debt service than on health and education combined. Similarly, in Mali, again, after debt relief under HIPC, the debt service is still 88 million, or it was in 2000, and that's greater than the government spending on health in a country where one in four children don't live to see their fifth birthday, and in a country where per capita spending on healthcare is $5, which doesn't meet the World Bank's own recommended level for basic healthcare expenditures of $12 per person per year. So one of the things that's weird and fascinating about this system is that there are many international venues, and the World Bank and the IMF are among them, where standards are articulated. And those standards aren't necessarily agreed to by all scholars who could look at them, like how much should be spent per capita on healthcare. But even those standards that do exist, that have been worked out in international venues like the United Nations and the World Bank, even those standards are routinely violated, directly violated by the policies of these organizations. Despite these statistics and many more that are widely available in the US and Europe, despite all kinds of information about how modernization and development theory and these institutions don't work, first world citizens still largely buy into this system, believing that its real purpose is to help those poor people over there. And that is the same paternalism left over from colonialism. The legacy of colonialism in Western ideology is as powerful as it is in the third world, where people were pummeled for hundreds of years to believe that anything from Europe was better than anything that they had before. The IMF and the World Bank are banks, but the profit that they generate is not money profit. The profit that they generate is control. They generate the right, the authority of the United States and other major economic powers to dictate economic policies and even laws in post-colonial nations, which is exactly what the colonial empires were able to do. They were able to dictate policies and laws in their own interests. This means that they dictate the conditions of daily life for the poorest of the poor in the world. And even the New York Times has acknowledged that the IMF and the World Bank are proxies of the US government because the US controls a sufficient percentage of the vote to have veto power. So we can't understand the globalization without understanding the political power that enforces economic policy. Economic policy is not operating even the way that economists say it should. I mean, they're not a terribly progressive lot, but economic policy is operating according to political priorities, and those political priorities are increasingly shaped by the most powerful economies and economic actors.
You have been listening to Professor Amory Starr present part one of her lecture, The History of Globalization. It concludes in part two. You can reach Professor Starr at www.trabal.org. That's www.trabal.org. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.